Hey everyone, this is Josh, host of the Urban Valor Podcast. Today's guest is Army veteran Jason Grammer. Jason grew up in Brewer, Mississippi, fishing, hunting, and spending most of his time outdoors. He was inspired to join the Army after watching a special on Operation Gothic Serpent, commonly referred to as Black Hawk Down. Jason enlisted into the infantry and was assigned to the 82nd Airborne. In this episode, he details the heavy combat he and his unit endured during Operation Iraqi Freedom, the invasion of Iraq in 2003. Jason leaves us with the struggle to transition out of the military after his experience in the Army. If you enjoy this episode, go give us a 5-star rating and leave a comment to help support our veterans. The bigger the community, the bigger the impact. If you'd like to contribute your story to Urban Valor or know anyone else who may, reach out on Instagram at Urban Valor TV, or you can email me at josh@urbanvalor.com. Enjoy the show.
My name is Jason Grammer. I started out in the Army with the 82nd Airborne Division in infantry. Total time in service, 13 years. I got out as a staff sergeant. 2000, 2004, and then 2007 to 2016. So I grew up in a small community south of Tupelo, Mississippi. It's called Brewer. Farmland, and everybody knows everybody kind of place. Everybody knows, you know, waves at you when you're driving down the road. Everybody hunts and fishes and goes to, you know, the football games every Friday night at the high school. And you could just kind of go off on your own and your parents didn't really have to worry about you. You could just go out and, you know, walk out in the woods, go hunt or do whatever and go fish. My mom worked at the local high school as a secretary. And then my dad was a firefighter for the city of Tupelo. And I'm the youngest of three. So I have my sister who's the oldest and a brother, and we're all about 4 years apart. For fun for us, it was some really redneck stuff. Yeah. It was like, we rode four-wheelers everywhere. The only real trouble we'd get into is we'd use people's land or field roads and go through their farmland and stuff. And people would get a little upset about that. And matter of fact, I got arrested one time because we used some guy's road to go down to go fish somewhere. And I guess somebody had been tearing up his fields and farmland, and they get pretty serious about that. And they thought it was us. So I just turned 18 and they came down and arrested me and like 10 other people. So for me, like, I was always fascinated by military technology and military history. The idea of like the individual soldier, like, how did they go through the things they did? Probably about, I don't know, I guess I was 12 or 13 years old. PBS, I was flipping the channels and PBS did the special on people that were from Mississippi that were in Operation Gothic Serpent, which is what everybody knows is Black Hawk Down. And so they were talking about it and they were talking about everything that happened. And I was just like, oh my God, I can't believe people fight like this. Like, I mean, I was pretty naive back then, you know, but I was like, oh my God. I was like, I didn't know this. I was like, okay, airborne infantry. I was like, maybe that, like, I always knew I was going to go in. I just didn't know what I was going to do. And then when I saw that, I was like, okay, airborne infantry. Rangers, maybe, maybe not. I don't know. I was like, but I'm going to go that route. I mean, I was probably 13 or 14 years old, and that's what set it in stone there. My recruiter probably, he said I was, I think, the easiest recruit he ever had. Because I came in, and I mean, there was no BS about it. I was just like, I want infantry. I want airborne. And I was like, can you do that? And he was like, done. And I mean, so it was the easiest experience ever. Like, there was no lies or anything like that you hear from other people where they're like, oh, I was told I was going to be one thing, and now I'm infantry. Yeah, for me, I knew exactly where I was going. Basic training for me, I guess, was kind of rough, you know, because I came from such a tight-knit neighborhood. So when I got in there, it was just like a huge culture shock. And I wasn't like a big guy. I think I was maybe like 2 pounds over the minimum to get in the Army. Tried to be the gray man. I just kind of stayed quiet, kept my head down. You know, a little bit of homesickness, too, because this is my first time away from home, and I don't know if I really ever got used to being there, but I just try to get in the rhythm of things and keep going. I mean, for me, like, the shock was just kind of, you had all these different people. I mean, people who came from backgrounds where they're like, you know, they came from the city, there were gangs and stuff like that. Like, I remember seeing one day, one of the guys, I don't know what started off, but guy was just like ironing his uniform. And I don't know what set it off, but next thing I know, I look over and that dude has got the can of starch back when you used to starch uniforms and everything. And he is just beating the absolute, like, wailing this guy on the head. like beating the crap out of him until we come over and stop him. And he's like gashed, cut this dude's head all open. Nobody would own up to anything because they weren't there at the time. And the only thing they got involved in was like that this guy was now cut up really bad. And then, you know, other times where I saw basically, you know, guys going to the bathroom and they kick the stall door open and then just go in there and start beating the crap out of the guy. Like if you were one of the guys who just kind of messed up all the time, you were going to get something.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and like I said, I was a small guy, so I just kept my head down and try to, you know, just get through it all. So the bad thing about our base training for everybody that was going to go to airborne school is we graduated airborne somewhere around mid-November. Well, in Fort Benning, Georgia, they do a Christmas exodus, which means no courses are run at all from like basically end of November till January. So we end up getting stuck at where we went to basic training at until January, which was horrible. And then finally got into airborne school and sometime in January, and we started that whole thing. Honestly, I loved airborne school. It sucked to be running everywhere in boots. Like every time you'd finish up lunch, and then next thing you know, you got to run all the way to where your next training area is. So you just kind of got in this habit of making sure you don't eat too much so you don't, you know, puke on the way.
Yeah.
So my first jump, I consider myself, I got lucky because I got to be the door jumper, which means when they open the doors and they tell you to stand by, you get to stand like right there on the door and see everything. And for at least, you know, 30 seconds or so. And it also means like when you go out of the plane, nobody's going to be around you for the most part. There's going to be a gap. So I remember I was standing there and I wasn't scared of anything. I was just excited. I just couldn't wait for it. I was like, oh man, this is going to be amazing. So I get the slap and they tell me to go and jump out and chute opens. And I'm like, okay, this is pretty cool. You know, we're just kind of floating up here and hit the ground. And of course I land in like this huge puddle of water. And it's like, you know, January, freezing cold water. And the one thing you're supposed to do is, you know, as soon as you hit, you got to pop your canopy release assembly so the chute will deflate. Well, that was kind of the part that I forgot. So next thing I know, I'm getting drugged for like 100 yards through all this water and it's just spraying all over the place. But, you know, other than being wet and cold, it was actually a blast. So we end up in 82nd, you know, you go through their whole replacement place and that's where they kind of start divvying people out and sending you to your whatever unit you're going to be in. So I got sent to the Charlie Company of the 2nd 325. I was in 3rd Platoon, so they put me in 3rd Platoon. And that's where you start to meet like your squad leaders, your team leaders and everything, and all the rest of the guys. They want all the new guys back then. They wanted you to go do a fun jump, is what they called it. But basically on Saturday, because this is pre 9/11, so the base was open. On Saturday, Sicily drop zone is like the biggest drop zone out there. They can actually land C-130s directly on the drop zone. So you get out there like 3 a.m, sign up for a jump, and there's you and a bunch of other people there. So you would get rigged up, and basically what they'd do is they would just hot load. So they'd land, load a stick up, lift them, drop them, wait till they cleared, land, and load a stick up. But since the base is open, families are out there, there's bleachers, and there's like people selling food and everything else. So they're watching all this. I remember it was me and another guy who, one of my best friends now, Justin, we were on maybe like the 6th or 7th lift or something like that to go up. So we're already rigged up and we're just sitting on the ground watching everybody go by. And we're watching one. As soon as they kind of get like right in the middle of the drop zone, these two guys come out and then you see them just go under the plane and wrap up. And they're just screaming in. I mean, they're getting maybe what 10% lift out of their chute. And normally what you're supposed to do in that situation is you're supposed to like, you know, push away from each other and pull a reserve. Now all the families and everything are seeing this and they're all screaming. All the jump masters are screaming, pull your reserve, pull your reserve, pull your reserve. And we're watching it and just, they never pull a reserve and they just boom, hit. And I remember thinking, I was like, oh shit. And everybody got quiet. Like you could have heard a pin drop. And I remember looking at my buddy Justin. I was like, you think you're going to jump? He's like, I don't know, man. About 10 minutes later, the jump master comes by and he's like, everybody derig, no more jumps today. And I was like, you got damn right, no more jumps today. I just saw a dude die. So one of them lived and one died. And that was like my first introduction to the 82nd. When it's something like that happens though, like they want to get you, like they want to turn you around and get you back on the plane as soon as they can. So it was maybe like another couple of days and I end up getting on a jump and jumping. So when you got to the unit, I wouldn't say there was like really any initiation. There was just crazy people. Like these dudes are just insane. When you're a brand new guy, like you would immediately, as soon as you were off work, you'd go to your room, just lock your door. Because if your door wasn't locked, they were going to come in there and just start messing with you or doing something. And there was one guy who, he would get drunk and then he would start walking around with this big copy of Moby Dick and quoting it and trying to find all the new guys. And this thing that he liked to do is he would like to put this big Viking helmet on. And he would always, when he got drunk, he had also had this big knife and he would hide it from himself. The problem was is he would hide it in that helmet. So when he got drunk, he put the helmet on, it hit him in the head. And next thing you know, he'd be walking around with this knife and Moby Dick in one hand. And he would just be scratching the knife down your door, telling you to come out and play. He'd be like, come out and play. I'm not going to hurt you. He's like, I just want to play. And my buddy Justin, who was a new guy, I got lucky. I was able to kind of stay out of a lot of it. But my buddy Justin, he didn't get so lucky. They were having a barbecue outside in the company area and they grabbed him up and then they taped him to the light pole that the barbecue was like right beside. Well, before they taped him up, they stripped him down naked and then taped him to the light pole. And then they just kept him there for the rest of the time they're barbecuing. One of the other NCOs, they walked by and they were just kind of like walking by and look and they, wait a minute. And they're like, you guys can't do this. You have to let this guy go. The way that 8-second does it is they just do it in a cycle. So you'll do like maybe one intense training cycle, the basic stuff, marksmanship and doing all that. And then it culminates with the, what they call exevals. So you'll parachute in somewhere with, you know, combat load. Usually you'll spend like the next 3 days just up, just constantly moving and doing stuff. And I remember, and they're pretty miserable times when you're doing that. And for whatever reason, we were doing one of them and I'd gotten held back. I think I was doing, getting ready for like a board of some kind, like promotion board maybe or something like that. So they had already jumped in and been up for like 2-3 days. And they're like, all right, come on, you're going to go out with these guys. So I go out there and I meet up with them and I'm fresh. I've had sleep and everything else. I'm walking and I'm just watching these guys and they're just, you know, they're just walking, but they're dead asleep. And you'd see the road turn and they just like keep walking and they'll fall down. Or you'll see they're dead asleep and they're walking. They'll hit like a puddle and they'll fall down. It's crazy seeing how bad off they were at that point. And once you got to that point, you would just be like, you'd start seeing stuff. Like you'd start seeing, you're just laying there looking for, you know, the enemy that's supposed to be out there. And you'd be like, oh, wait, is that a bad guy? And somebody's like, I didn't see anything. And it's just your head's just playing tricks on you. Like your eyes are playing tricks on you. You're just seeing stuff moving through the bushes. 9/11 happened. We were playing op four for another unit in 8-second. And so we were actually dug in positions like fighting positions and waiting on them to attack us. And we're just kind of sitting around and somebody, there's just a lot of radio chatter. One of the NCOs comes over and he's like, there's a plane has hit one of the World Trade Centers. I was naive. I was young. I didn't know. I was like, I don't even know what the World Trade Centers are. And plus they used to do this thing in 8-second where they would just mess with you. They'd be like, oh, you know, we're going to war. We used to do these things where you get a call out, you'd load up on a plane. They would load you up all your gear like you were going to war. And then you would parachute out and be like in Florida. And they're like, just kidding. We're in Florida. So I thought they were just messing with us. And then they come back and they're like, hey, another plane has hit the other tower. And then people started getting a little more serious. And about maybe 10, 20 minutes later, they come over and they're like, look, leave the holes, leave any non-mission essential equipment, get on the trucks. We're going back. He's like, we're going to start our process. You know, everybody loads up on the trucks and they know it's for real. So everybody's just kind of like, yeah, we're going to war, boys. We're going to get them, you know, and then the route we had to take home went past the Delta Force compound. And as soon as we passed by that, we all kind of looked over and you could just see like all of them. They have like multiple helicopters out there and they're just loading gear constant. They're leaving like that day. And then we hit the street that comes from all the training areas. It's called Long Street, probably 5 or 6 miles long. And it's just truck after truck after truck after truck because they're pulling everyone in. And once everybody saw that, like all that bravado kind of went away. And it was like quiet for like the next hour that took us to get back. So once 9/11 happened, we were expecting to go somewhere like right off the bat. And then they sent one of the other brigades to Afghanistan. And we just kind of were sitting there like, what's going on? Why are we not going? And then all of a sudden we started doing this training cycle. And like, they didn't tell us, like, they just said, hey, you're going to go somewhere, but they didn't tell us where we're going or what we're going to do. So we ended up doing this training cycle, and you just kind of knew something was going on because we would start training. Like, if we did training mission with the Rangers, and it was oddly specific, you know, versus what we used to do, just parachute in somewhere, take an area, move over, movement to contact. Like, these were like very specific, like, you're going to go here, here, you're going to do this sort of movement. And then we started getting like uniforms. So we got like our desert uniforms, and we still don't know where we're going. And then we had a rotation at NTC, the National Training Center in the desert. We parachuted in, and we just spent like the next like week or two doing all these missions. And at that time, we kind of started figuring out where we're going, because the missions that they were having us doing were, somebody was like, oh, this is based off a mission between the Iraq-Iran war. We're like, okay, well, it must be Iraq. Mm-hmm. But no, still, we don't have an idea of exactly what we're doing. So the R Brigade is made up of three battalions. So we're 2nd Battalion. And the 1st and 3rd Battalion, they got sent to Kuwait. And then we're told that we're not going to go with them. We're like, they're like, 2nd Battalion, you're going to get attached to JSOC. We stayed back for like another 2 or 3 weeks and then came into work one Monday morning. We weren't supposed to leave till like Thursday or Friday. Came into work Monday, and they're like, you got 1 hour to say your goodbyes. You're leaving today. I had a girlfriend at the time, so you know, called her. And I called my parents and just said, hey, you know, today's the day, so I don't know how long it'll be before I'll talk to you again. So I'd kind of already had some of the hard conversations before then, you know, because you, when you know you're going, it's just like, I wasn't scared of going. I had a lot of anxiety about it, but it was emotional to kind of be like, all right, I need to call you now and say my goodbye just in case the worst happens. Talked to my mom, my dad, my brother and sister. And I was like, look, I love you guys. I was like, I don't know what's going to happen. I was like, but just know that I love you and that, you know, I'm at least doing what I want to do. We still don't know our mission. Still have no idea. There's only like 2 people that know what we're supposed to do. So we go to Green Ramp, which is the area that everybody goes when they're getting ready to go parachute or rig up or anything. It's just these big warehouses, and they're right on the flight line where all the planes are. And we're there, and we're loading up all our ammo and everything and getting everything issued to us. And finally, our commander calls us over, and he lays out a big map, and I see it says Baghdad. And he points kind of like up to the northwest part of Baghdad. He said, this is Saddam International Airport. He said, it is our job in conjunction with the Rangers to parachute in and to take over this airport. And I remember when I heard that, I looked at the guy beside me. I go, is he serious? I was like, I didn't ever think something like this would happen. So then, you know, we're like, I'm kind of stunned. I'm like, holy crap, we're going to go parachute into this place. So we get back, and they're doing final formation to get on the bird to go over. And we're in formation. All of a sudden, I hear my name get called. And I'm just thinking, I'm like, oh, man, I must have screwed something up. So I break ranks. I run out in the front. And I still don't know. I'm like, man, I'm trying to think of everything. My commander comes over to me. And he pulls out his knife, and he starts to cut my rank off of my collar. And I'm like, well, all right, either I'm getting demoted or promoted. I don't know which one this is. And they, all of a sudden, he pins sergeant stripes on me. And then he goes, all right, you're a sergeant. I said, get on the bird. We're going to fucking war. And I remember thinking, shit. I was like, I'm going to have to learn all. I mean, I learned a lot anyway, because when you're in, you learn everybody's job. But I was like, now I'm going to have to do all this for the first time in combat. So I'd already went through the board and done all that stuff. I just figured, I was like, okay, because we're going to war. Like, that's just going to be later. Like, we'll mess around with that later. But I guess the orders just kind of came in right when we were leaving. We were on a C-17 to fly over. So we're flying straight to where we're going. And they second, they'd start doing this thing called force hydration, where since you don't know what you're going to do the minute you hit the ground, like, everybody will just start chugging water. So we get about halfway over there, and like, all the bathrooms in the airplane are just spilling over into the floor. We get over to there, and we land in this place called RR in Saudi Arabia. And I remember when the tailgate went down, it was cold. And it just surprised me for some reason. I was like, man, it's freezing. I did not expect that. So we go in RR, and we meet up with kind of everybody else. And that's where we spend like one day in like this holding area, like this one big tent that we're all in. We basically build a whole city in like a day between us and the Rangers. We all go out there and just tents. and we built up like all their talks and everything. We ended up having a one big tent that had this giant model of Baghdad International Airport. And then we had up-to-date like satellite photos of everything on that whole bay, on that whole airport. So we'd go in there like two times a day and just checking like everything and memorizing everything. At this point in time, like the war's already kicked off. So we're sitting around just like, all right, man, is this going to be another thing like Afghanistan? We're just going to be sitting here and not get to go do anything. And the Rangers had jumped in on a couple airfields and taken those that were, because there was basically like two or three airfields from going west to east in Iraq before you went to Bayab. So they were jumping in and securing those and basically getting footholds. And then finally kind of it came the day where they were like, it was going to be a go or no go scenario, like whether or not we're going to jump in. And the idea was if Third ID was doing what's called the Thunder Run from Kuwait to Baghdad. And if any of the bridges got blown over the rivers and or they got held up by supply chain issues, then we would have to be the ones to parachute in. And, you know, as you know, Third ID ended up making all the way into Baghdad, and they're still going to make us parachute in. They ran the numbers, and they're like, give us a no BS assessment of what we're expecting for casualties if we do this Air One operation. And they're like, well, we expect to lose 20% on the way in, and another 20% on the ground. And they're like, so you're expecting us to lose almost half of our fighting force on the way in. And then that's when they're like, all right, well, no reason to jump now. Like, we'll just send them in and to Lille. Which, I mean, it got close. I mean, it was close enough. Like, I was in my chute. I was already rigging up and I was like about to get my ruck and everything snapped in. And they came by and they're like, all right, mission scrubbed. Like, we're not jumping. We're flying in. Like everything back then, like I wasn't really scared. I didn't know enough to be scared at this point. So it was fun though, because we all get in there, we're all packed in there with all our gear and everything, and they didn't have seats or anything in the plane. And we all basically snapped into the little D-rings that are in the floor. And that's what held us to the ground. Because, I mean, when they come in, basically they'll be at altitude. And then right when they get to where they need to be, they will just slam it to the ground. And next thing, if you're not snapped in inside that plane, you're just like floating in there. They slam it in and they land the bird. And I remember the tailgate goes down and it was just like pitch black, like the darkest night I've ever seen. And we're walking out. And there were probably 100 people around me and I couldn't even see the person to my left and right. The only thing I could see is like one guy had a chem light on the very front and he was leading us to where we need to go. And we spent that first night in, it was a hangar that had been hit by a missile. And I was like sleeping basically in where the crater where that missile hit. And like I was looking above and it was just like all the big I-beams were all bent in and everything. And I remember thinking, all right, we're here now. Like we're in it. The first few missions that we did were basically, so because when Third ID did the run up to Baghdad, they basically skipped all these other pockets or bigger cities. Like they wanted to just get by them and not get bogged down in any fights. So we started kind of hitting some of these cities they missed and just kind of walking through and patrolling through and just seeing if anybody was going to attack us. That was kind of what it was. And then we came to a city called Asamoa. And this one's where, like, we already knew this one was a city where the people that were there were ready to fight. They're going to stay and fight. So we got in the mission that this was going to be the big one. So we end up driving up on trucks. We end up stopping on an embankment of a highway and using it as our staging area to go in. You know, and by this time we've been up for, you know, probably 30 hours, 36 hours, and everybody's just getting ready. Everybody's, you know, getting their gear ready and, you know, going around. Like I had one of my friends and I just kind of was like, we did the thing, you know, here's a letter to my family. If I get killed, Mar, you take it. And he'd give me the letter, you know, give this to my family. And remember, because nobody, like, we really hadn't been in any sort of contact at this point. So, and nobody with us had. So we had no idea. Like, I was thinking tomorrow when the sun comes up, it's going to be the last sunrise I see. The only thing you're thinking about is all the different scenarios that could happen. And we finally get the word to move out. And so basically what we're doing is Asamoa is split by the Euphrates. And we're going to go and move into the south side. And then our main goal was to cross over and take the other side of the city too. But if we can't move across, the goal was to block the bridges because there were three bridges that were there. We start off walking. I mean, none of us have slept in like 2 days now. we're walking in the city, and everybody's, you know, kind of, you know, when you get sleep deprived, you get a little giddy sometimes. So I remember walking, and we hit this area that was just like this. It was this field, but it was like this crust on top of the field. But if you've ever been in one, like, it's like walking on ice. Mm. It's just slippery as all get out. And we didn't have rucks on us, but we had like 14 full mags. I had 20 something, two or three rounds, grenade rounds. I had so many grenade rounds that my vest was full, and I had like six or seven in each cargo pocket, HEDP grenades. And that was the only way I could carry it. And even without rucks, we had probably 100 pounds of gear on. So we're walking, we hit this field, and of course people are just slipping and busting their ass. And of course we're starting to laugh, like it's funny as hell to us, because then they try to get up and they're just like, it looks like somebody, you know, just moving their legs on ice and falling back down. And finally our platoon sergeant, he just gets sick of it. And he's like, he turns around and he goes, "You motherfuckers." He said, "If you don't shut up and start acting like professionals," he goes, "I'm an Article 15 your ass." And he turns around and takes one step, and his feet fly in the air, and we just lose it. We're just laughing our ass off. We're like, "Oh my God. Oh my God, he can't Article 15 all of us." So we pick up from that and kind of recover from that. And we're walking in. It feels like we've been walking forever. The sun's starting to come up. And the minute the sun came up, the minute it came up, there were just all of a sudden tracer rounds just going in the air. Gunfire started. I see my first Iraqi because we end up going, we hit a road, and they, you know, I went up to go pull security on the road, and I see this guy out there, and he's the first Iraqi I've ever seen. He's just like sweeping his driveway. I start to aim at him, and he looks up and sees me, and then he just takes off running. And of course, they're like, "Why didn't you shoot the guy?" I was like, "Well, I mean, yeah, he could have been a spotter." I was like, "But he's out here just taking care of his yard like anybody else would." So we keep moving, and I'm pretty much on point at this time. So I'm walking, and all of a sudden I just step up on this road, and I look, and I'm like, "Oh shit, we're here." I was like, and there was so much gunfire at this point that you're having to scream at other people to tell them what to do, because all the incoming gunfire is just nothing but snaps and cracks. As young as I was, I thought, "What are they shooting at us?" Because it doesn't sound like, you know, like a big gun. It's something when you get just that snap. I was like, "Oh, are they just shooting 22s or something?" I didn't realize. I was like, "No, that's what it sounds like when it's coming at you." We get up, we get down on the road, and I'm, you know, all this gunfire is going on. I'm looking around. I'm trying to find something. I hop down on this pile of bricks by one of our snipers. I'm like, "Hey, man," I was like, you see anything?" He's like, "I don't see nothing." I was like, "What are they shooting at?" He's like, "I don't know." And he said, "But they're shooting at something. There's a bunch of incoming gunfire." And then where we came up at was like 300 yards down from where we needed to be. So we start to get up to try to move down there. And the way the road was like elevated. So we could get down behind that road and have kind of cover from the north side of the city where they're shooting us from. So we get down there, we start moving, and the mortar team is set up over there, and they're about to start firing. So they told us to stop. And I was like, "Okay." I was like, I'll watch some mortars for a second. And they load up a mortar, they drop it. It was the first time in my life I was ever able to actually see the mortar the entire time. And I could see it the whole time, which means that thing's not going far. And I was like, "Oh shit, that's going to be close." And about 200 yards away on the river, there was kind of like this little sandbar with some bushes. And I hear it hits right there. And then I hear over the radio, "Fire for effect." And I was like, "Oh, this is going to be good." So they drop five rounds whenever they say "fire for effect." So they drop five rounds. I'm watching them, and I watch them hit. And all of a sudden I just see like half of a shoulder and an arm just go flying like 60 feet in the air. And I was like, "Oh shit." I was like, "This is cool." Like, I mean, to me that whole day, I was just excited. Like, I was like a kid in a candy shop. I was like, "This is amazing." We're moving down there. We kind of hit this area to where we can't use the road as cover anymore. So the trucks, our gun trucks, they had been up on the road, basically just going back and forth and just raking everything. So they got this idea to move the trucks back to where we were, and then to have us use them as cover to move us up. The problem is we've got so much gear on us that, you know, we get up on that road, and even if that Humvee was at an idle, I still couldn't keep up with it. Like, none of us could. It was maybe 100 yards before the Humvee is just gone, and we're just running out in the open. And all you're hearing is just constant snaps and gunfire just going by. And I remember running, and my buddy Duyon, who was the commander's radio operator, was like sitting in a ditch, and I see him, and he's like, yeah, screaming at me. He's like, they're shooting at you right now. They're shooting at you right over there. He's like, get your ass in here. So I just kind of go and dive headfirst into there. And at this point, we succeeded in at least part of our mission. There was a dump truck that was coming across one of the bridges. And I mean, whether or not he was a bad guy or not, he was just in the wrong place. And they pieced that guy up. The whole cab of that truck was just red, just solid. Because I think everybody that came up there put rounds into that car. So now we're pretty close to where we need to be. There's a house that was basically directly in front of the bridge. And it had like this courtyard that shielded us. It was open to the side we had just come from, but it was shielded on every other side. That was when I saw my first wounded American. So I walk up and there's this guy. He wasn't with us, but his whole arm and everything's bandaged up. And I was like, oh man, I walk up and say, what happened, man? And he was like in such shock. Like he couldn't really get it out. He was like, RPG, hit the wall. He said, shrapnel. And that was like all he could say. And I just kind of looked at him and went, oh, I was like, sucks to be you, dude. And I just kept walking, doing. And then, so we're standing there waiting to get the word to go across and push across. I'm getting a little bored. So I go kind of outside. I'm looking to where the enemy is. I'm trying to find some target to engage. And we'd already been told like, hey, there's our first battalion is behind you. So your rear is secure. Don't shoot behind you. And all of a sudden I hear like what I knew instinctively was AK, and it was like right behind me. So I hit the dirt and I turn and there's a guy and he's maybe 30 feet, 20 feet away. And he is just dumping a whole mag. And there's probably 40 of us in this courtyard. And he is just dumping a whole mag just right across everybody. To this day, my biggest regret of that war is not dropping that guy. But when I turned around, it happened so quick. I didn't know, like all I saw was a silhouette. And then I also didn't know like who it was or if there were one of our group behind us or anything. Some dude had just worked his way behind us. He dumps a whole mag into like 30 or 40 of us and hits no one. It goes through like one guy had around go through like his backpack. I think a couple of guys had like, I mean, they're like close calls. Like there were like holes in their shirts and stuff, but it was like Pulp Fiction. Everybody's just kind of like looking around like, what the hell just happened? So then me and another guy get up and we start trying to chase this guy, but I mean, he was gone. He beat feet as soon as he dumped that mag. And we're like, okay, we can't, our rear's not secure. So then they asked me to go and clear up to the top of one of these buildings for the snipers. And we clear up to the top of the building. And I remember it, like I stuck my head up for like a little bit to go up on the rooftop. And it was just incoming gunfire, like nonstop, like just pieces of the rooftop were just flying off. And I was crouched down behind the wall and my team leader was there. And I was like, are we staying up here with these snipers? He's like, nope. I was like, good, let's get the hell out of here. Like, this is insane. I don't know how they're going to do anything up here. I guess what was happening with the command is they, for whatever reason, were having like communication problems with the battalion commander who was in the rear. So that's why we hadn't got the word yet to push across. While we're still standing there, I remember just seeing like RPGs fly over and I was like, oh, wow. I was like, they're shooting rockets. I was like, cool. I was like, this is a good day. This is fun. We're there from sun up till, I don't know, about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, just back and forth with all this. And finally, kind of word, they get comms up and they're like, you guys are just going to pull out. We're just going to pull out. We're going to refit ammo and everything else. And then we're going to hit them again. So then we had a cavalry unit or something that was attached to us. And so they pull up with Bradleys and cover our exfil out of there. I was talking to a couple other guys, our exfil out of there, because we had to walk out. And I think maybe we only walked like 4 or 5 miles. So we walked out to the desert and they're like a patrol base set up. But that walkout was the hardest ruck that we've ever done. Like it was the most miserable, challenging ruck I've ever done in my life. And I thought it was just me. And then I talked to my commander and a couple other guys that were there and they're like, no, that goes down in history as like the worst walk I've ever done. Because we all been up for around 48 hours and now we're all coming down off an adrenaline rush and most of us haven't eaten or anything. So I mean, just you're exhausted. Like you had to keep telling yourself, like you would walk and start to kind of like nod off. You had to tell yourself like, oh, we're still in the fight. Like it's still, somebody could be right over here. I remember seeing some of the toughest guys I've ever worked with. They were just like, the minute we halted, they were just like, boom, they'd fall down on their backs and just be out. To this day, that's the most most gunfire I've ever heard in my life. We went, we refitted, just got more ammo and supplies and everything. Everybody got some rest. So we hit it maybe like 2 days later. I think we must have just trucked right back, right up to where we were at this time. So we didn't have to walk in. And this time we ran across the bridge. There's the bridge there. We start moving out and taking some of the buildings that they had been engaging us from. One of the buildings was like the schoolhouse that was right there on the other side of the river. So we go into that. I remember kind of running in and looking over to my left. It was this big room. It must have been a classroom or something, but it was stacked from top to bottom with, you know, ammo, chem suits, gas masks, like everything was in there. So we run up and clear that whole thing out, but we really didn't have that much trouble on the second go. Like, I think the first go around kind of made them realize, like, they're not going to be able to stand and fight with us. And there was one guy who stayed in the area. It was a sniper. He had shot, like, one of the medics, like, the day before and killed him. And they couldn't find where he was operating from. From that schoolhouse, there was a road, like a big four-lane highway. And we had to cross it. I remember, you know, we send two guys across it. Me and another guy, we start running across it. And I mean, about the time I get to the middle of it, I just hear, pow! And I'm like, oh shit. Like, you try to get as small as you can and you're trying to run as fast as you can, but like your legs just won't work. And then I get over to where the other guys were and they're against this wall. And I was like, do you hear that? And the other guy goes, yeah. He goes, it hit right here. I was like, and we're still here? What do we do? I was like, move. We got to move the hell out of the way, man. We stayed in that city for about another, I don't know, week, and then we moved on. I mean, that deployment, it was just the Wild West. Like, our rules of engagement were so open. I mean, if somebody didn't put their hands up, they were fair game. If you were a type of person who didn't have a conscience, I mean, you could have done some damage. Thing about being in 8 seconds, like, we don't have vehicles to transport us around. I mean, we have, like, one truck company for the whole battalion. So if we wanted to go out and do missions on a company level, like we took over a couple like Toyota Hiluxes, and that's like what we did missions out of. Or we had like a bongo truck that we just all set on and did that. And then there were times where like we would essentially carjack people and take their car. So I can't remember what the reason was. I know we had to get somewhere real quick, and it was me and another guy. We stopped this car. And I'm trying to tell the guy to get out of the car, get out of the car, and he won't do it. And he's not listening. So finally, I kind of lose my patience with him. And I remember I reach in, just grab him by his head and pull him through his window. And I remember thinking as I'm doing it, I'm like, this is a lot harder to do in real life than what you see in the movies. So I pull him out, you know, put him on the ground. We had these cards that basically said, you know, if we've taken anything in years, take this card to the nearest Americans. Hand him the car, hop in, like it was like a Honda Civic. And next thing you know, it was like me and my one buddy, we're just on our own doing like 90 miles an hour through Baghdad, trying to get to where we're going. I mean, and that was like commonplace. Like, we did it a lot. I was like, you know, we'd go to jail for this if in the States. Like, we just carjacked somebody. That's what we just did. Even though I got promoted to a sergeant, they still kept our team together. So, I mean, we had a pretty stacked team. But eventually, you know, a little bit later, once we got settled into Baghdad, they gave me, you know, I became a team leader. We're staying in our Cob in southern Baghdad. And all of a sudden, we're all down for the night. And then about 2 a.m., they just cut all the lights on and they wake all of us up. And they're like, people are running frantic. And they're like, hey, we got this mission. It's outside of our area. It's, you know, SF basically. Special forces needed help because they're going to hit multiple houses and they had the manpower to do it. So we're going to take this house. And immediately I just had a bad feeling about it. I was like, this is not going to be good. And they're tasked my squad with being the assaulting team going in. So me and the other team leader and the squad leader are standing around. We're just kind of like talking like, okay, who's going to do what? And the other team leader, he had been gone on leave for like the past week or so. So I was like, look, I was like, I've been leading every mission for like the past 2 weeks. I was like, this one's yours. And it was the right call. Cause I'm telling you, I had a bad feeling about it from the get go. Cause when we weren't in our area of operations, it was happening so fast. We had no intel at all on the houses. Usually we would do, you know, a couple drive-bys or something, you know, in the weeks leading up to something that before we hit it. So anyway, we load up the other team. They're going to be the ones that breach the door. we're going to pull up next to the wall because all the houses there had basically had a, about an 8 to 10 foot wall and then a little bit of a courtyard. And then it was the front of the house. My job was to get the first team over the wall, get my two team members over the wall, then get myself over. And then while they were going to breach the door, like I had the bolt cutter. So I was going to go and pop the lock on the gate and then join up with them and flow inside the house. I get the first team over perfectly fine. Everything's going fine. The problem came when he went to go breach the door. In most houses, it was usually you had a front door that went to like the kitchen area and another like wooden door that went into like a living room area. And then that was it. Well, this one had like another hallway and it was a metal door on the outside. So it took him a lot longer to get in. Like I was already getting over the wall and he still wasn't in the house yet. As soon as I popped the lock on the gate is when he finally made entry into both doors. And the minute he did, it just gunfire, nothing but gunfire. So I popped the lock and all the gunfire starts. I hit the dirt and I'm basically low crawling to get up to where my guys are staged at. And I'm looking at the doorway that they went in. I'm trying to count how many people I see. So I'm counting because some of them are jumping out of the doorway now. I see them dragging someone out of the doorway. So I'm counting. I'm like, okay, there's 1, 2, 3, 4. I was like, all right, we're good. Like everybody's out of the building now. But what happened is basically as soon as he made entry, they turned into that room and the guy was in the next room over and he just started unloading on them. The second guy in, he caught around, went in here, traveled up his arm, came out his bicep, then went into his side, but luckily that time it slowed down enough that the armor caught it, but it went around on the inside of the armor and kind of burned him a little bit. So he dropped, and then the other team leader that was there, he turned and he started shooting back, and then he catches either a ricochet or just one right off the chin and kind of grazes him, but it knocks him out cold. At that point in time, I'm like counting people to make sure like they're all out of there. So I know like, okay, if anybody else comes out this door, they're dead. What I didn't know, or I forgot, I don't remember which now, they had taken one of the other team leaders from the other team and they had plussed up that breach team. So when I counted, I only counted for just that team and not the extra guy. So I'm sitting here and I'm thinking I'm ready if anything, because I've crawled up by this point and the whole rest of the platoon is on this wall. And now we're just in this crossfire, like me and my three guys. So they're just machine gun in this whole house, every window, everything above my head, ricochets are flying down. And I've crawled up to where I'm basically laying on my side and I can see in the doorway, but it's pitch black and I can't really see anything. I start seeing movement. So I'm thinking to myself, I was like, oh yeah, come on out. I was like, I'm gonna get you. I see something start coming towards me and I'm already on fire. I'm on the trigger, I'm pulling. And then also when it comes in full view, I see helmet and body armor and in a U.S. uniform, but like I'm already like on it. So I kind of jerk off at the last second and the round goes off. Like I'm already pulled. In that moment, like I see him come out. I guess he's still concussed and everything else. But the way that he moves, I thought I'd shot him. Mm. I really thought I'd shot him. Cause I saw him just kind of like his shoulder jerk or something like that. And he falls down and they drag him out. So now I'm there and I'm just like, I just shot one of my own guys. I was like, what the hell am I going to do with this now? But I'm still in the fight. So I'm still there. So now we're just stuck there. And one of my guys is screaming at me. He's like, Sergeant, what do we do? What do we do? And I was like, keep your head down. I was like, cause if you stand up right now, either our guys are going to end up shooting you in the head, or they're going to end up shooting you in the head. I was like, just stay down and wait. I'm just standing on the door. And all of a sudden another person comes out the door and it's just the woman from in there. And I don't know why I did this or what, but I just told her, go back in the house. Just go back in the house. I was like, we'll deal with it later. I don't know how long it was, but all the gunfire stops and I hear them call and they're like, Grammer, take your team in. And this is where I kind of credit the team I had, that they were really, really good. Cause I never told them anything. I just jumped up and started going in. And I remember as soon as you get to the entry of the doorway, there was an M4 laying there. And I was like, it just really weird. It just kind of stuck with me. So I go to turn in the house fully expecting like the minute I turn into this room, I'm just going to get pieced up. So I go in, I'm just gritting my teeth and embracing. And then I go in the first room There's nothing there. Like we clear it and there's nobody in the first room. We go in the second room and it's like the middle of the house. And there's a staircase. And then I look over and I see two closed doors. And I know those are typically like bedrooms. And I'm like, crap. By this time, nobody's followed me in there. So it's just us. Well, it was just three of us in there. So I put my saw gunner, machine gunner, I put him on the staircase. I was like, you watch the staircase, make sure nobody comes down it. And then we go, I just pick a door and we go to this door and I'm about to, I look at my other guy. I was like, look, I don't know what's behind this door. I was like, I'm going to dump half a mag in here, kick the door open, and then you're going to go in. And right as I'm getting ready to do that, I hear my guy on the stairwell. He goes, I got him. And I look over and there's no railing on the second story. I look over and watch him. He's a big Samoan dude. He jumps up and grabs this dude by his head and just pulls him down to the first floor. And so as soon as he does that, I just ignore the two rooms that are there because people are starting to flow in now. And I go, hey, two rooms unclear. And I roll up the staircase and I basically have to step over this dude to get up the staircase. And then that's where there's like one more guy that was up there who was one of the guys we're looking for. And then the rest of it was just like his family. So our medic that we had with us was amazing. Loved the guy to death. Like Bobby, probably the best medic we ever had. But when the guy got shot in the arm, they drag him out and medic's starting to get to work on him. And he pulls out the morphine and he goes to slap the morphine in him. And somehow it rolled or just did something. And he slaps it. And he goes, ah, and he holds his hand up. He accidentally stuck himself with the morphine. He's like, oh man, don't worry. He said, we got you another one coming. He's like, we got you another one coming. He sticks him. And I was like, Bobby, what'd you do? He said, I didn't do shit. I was messed up. When we got to Baghdad, there was this big ammo depot. And 101st was like guarding it. I mean, this thing had everything. There was missiles and grenades and everything. We pull up. And as we pull up, we just hear like a 3-round burst go off. And we're like, what the hell was that? Because it definitely was like an American gun. Like, and there's nothing around going on right now. About, you know, a minute later, somebody comes running up to us. They're like, hey, do you guys have a medic? We need a medic. So Bobby, the guy I was mentioning, he runs over there. I kind of walk over there to get close, but I'm not trying to get like in anybody's way. And basically what happened is like one of the 101st guys was, for whatever reason, had decided to grab his machine gun from the front. And somehow it got knocked off safe. And he ended up firing a 3-round burst directly into his, you know, upper thigh. It hit him in the femoral. So they're like, he's bleeding out. So our medic runs over there and he's trying to just do some stuff and it's just not working. So finally he's just like, he starts grabbing every roll of Curlex he had and he just starts shoving it in this guy's leg. And he shoves like six of these things in his leg. I mean, to the point where like I looked over and his arm was up to the elbow in this guy's leg. And I was just like, yep, I don't need to see that anymore. And I was like, I'm going to walk back. But he ends up saving this dude's life. And if that guy's out there, like I know my buddy would love to get a hold of him and talk. So that ammo depot though. So we're out there and we're having to guard it. And finally, I mean, there's huge artillery pieces there, huge artillery rounds there. Everything, anything and everything. I guess they just didn't have anything better for us to do. So they were like, hey, we're going to load all this stuff up on trucks and we're going to take it to buy-up. So Baghdad International Airport, and we're going to give it to the EOD guys. And I was like, hold on a second now. I was like, you see all this stuff? I was like, A, there's a ton of it. I was like, B, I was like, has anybody looked at this stuff that knows what they're talking about that can say this is safe? And they're like, oh yeah, our engineers looked at it. I was like, no. Did they really look at it or did you just tell them what it was? Basically, I got told to, you know, shut the fuck up and do what I'm told. So we load, I think like 3 trucks full of just already around. I mean, they still have fuses in them, mortar rounds, fuses in them, and we're just tossing them up onto the truck and they're stacking them up. We drive it all the way up to buy up and we start driving up to where the EOD guys are. And there's one of the guys out there. He's just like smoking a cigarette and he's kind of like, he can start to see what it is. He just throws the cigarette down. And he starts running and he runs. He's like, everybody stop. What you're doing? He's like, get your asses off the truck. He's like, I don't know how you're not dead. He's like, these things still have fuses. These things are still armed. But out of all the big things, like, I mean, there's huge artillery rounds and like missiles. The one thing they're most terrified of was like this big, and it was a shape charge that was used to blow holes in the bottom of ships. And I mean, these are things that we had just been tossing. And him and another guy come out there and they take this, like a big serving platter, and they just set it on there. And then they like walk it like 300 yards away from everything else. That's how terrified they were of it. Like they didn't want to deal with it. they were like, yeah, this thing's already killed like four people. And this is like maybe 2 months in. But what it was, it's so sensitive. Like if that pin moves out a little bit and then moves back in and it has like a grain of sand or anything on it, it blows. And they're like, yeah, we don't know how your guy's alive. It's like vindication for me though, because I was looking around at all those staff sergeants and I was being like, see, I told you, you son of a bitch. Like, we should not be messing with this stuff. So they came down and blew it. I mean, it was huge. It shattered like every window and for like a mile radius. So when I first got out, I was driving from, you know, Fort Bragg to where my hometown was. I had to go through Atlanta. And I had a good friend who had been in the 82nd, who was living in Atlanta. I used to always stop in and see him. I thought I had a plan for getting out, but, you know, I really didn't. I was just kind of like, just checking the boxes. So I drove through Atlanta, met up with my buddy, and he was like, hey, man, we got, you know, open room if you just want to stay here. And I think it was great, but it was a double-edged sword because I lived with two other guys, and both of them had been in the invasion, but they had been in different units. So it was great because, like, we all understood each other, and we all knew what we'd all been, you know, what each other had been through, and we're able to, like, talk through it and stuff and just talk about. And I think that's a big thing, is just being able to talk about it. Not even if anybody's really giving you any feedback or anything, but if you could just talk to someone who's had a similar experience or anything like that, like, it helps. But it was, like I said, it was a double-edged sword because we all still had that warrior mentality of, you know, work hard, play hard. We were just out drinking every day. And I mean, we all had some version of PTSD, and that's kind of how it was showing up, is just through alcohol. You always think you're perfectly fine. And you're, oh, no, I'm fine. You know, 2.5 years of that, I mean, it was spent just being, you know, drunk. You know, I mean, every day it was just like, hey, where are we going to party at today? And that's, you're young too. So you know, I'm 21, 22. So you're just thinking like, oh, this is just what everybody does. Like, we're just having fun and drinking like everybody else. But in reality, it's just, you're just numbing. Even to this day, I still watch people's hands. You know, when we're going through there, I hate being in huge crowds. I mean, I can deal with it. It doesn't like make me shut down or anything, but I just don't like it as much. But back then, I would say, like, anxiety wise, like, we were just covering it up with alcohol. For me back then, like early on, it was like the anger issues. Cause I was always a real chill, laid back guy, go with the flow kind of guy. And then when I was overseas during the deployment, like, I felt like in order for me to actually lead this team the way they needed to be, I needed to be a little more aggressive. And the way I did it was just by like trying to figure out how to just be angry. And I mean, it sounds silly, but I mean, it's like, yeah, just channel that anger like all the time when we're out. Mm-hmm. And the problem was when I got back, there's no way of shutting it off. I never went out and sought like help for it. Like, I just didn't understand it. I was just like, I don't know why this is the way that I am right now. I've tried therapy a few times with different outcomes. One of the guys I went to him for a couple of months, but I mean, it was never more than, oh, how's your day going? How's your week going? Like, he never tried to dig into anything. And I'm like, I'm not just going to volunteer it to you. And then I had another guy that I was actually, when I did my stuff for VA disability, he was the one who interviewed me. And like everything he said, I was like, yes. I was like, that's perfect. Like, he was like, do you have anger issues? Like, yes. He's like, do you sometimes just, you know, feel like you're just going to cry for no reason? Like, you just feel like something's like welling up? I was like, yes. I was like, absolutely. For me, the most difficult thing was just trying to find a purpose. Like, you go from being overseas where every decision you make, every small, like, did I eat today? Does my guy have water in his canteens or whatever? Like, every decision means something. And then you come home, and like that first time that I got out of the military, I came home and I was working in bars and restaurants. And I'm like, I'm supposed to, you know, give a crap about this person wants a ranch for their salad or something? I was like, I don't care. So you just start feeling like what you're doing has no meaning. And so I spent years just kind of like trying to figure out like what I was going to do. And for me, it ended up being just to go into the guard and go back in to get just, I mean, if anything, just to get around other people that were like me, at least for once a month, you know, that let that be my therapy. Went into the Georgia National Guard. And so once a month I got to go and just hang out with people who were just like me. And a lot of those guys were prior service. So they'd been, you know, been in before. It was good to have structure again, a goal that I could work towards, and then to be around other people like me. got a great family. My wife is, she's probably been my biggest support structure there is. I mean, she's got the medical background, like I was telling you. So she understood like what I was going through. She was like, look, you have all these markers for, you know, PTSD, for this. She goes, I can tell you that you have these markers, but I'm not the one trained to be able to help you out with them. And so she's been real big on pushing me to go like, hey, if there's an event with other veterans and stuff like that, don't worry about it. I'll take care of the kids. I'll take care of everything. Go. And just like helping me get like any help I need. And I think that's a huge deal. If you have a family support structure, that's going to carry you a long ways. There's a group out there called Heart Support. They're not exclusively a veteran thing, but they do have a veteran arm that deals with mental health. And it's kind of a novel idea. What they do is just kind of get people together and they'll look for just music festivals or concerts, and they'll get all these guys together. Like for us, we had a bunch of vets. We all got together and went to like a rock concert, and they got us all backstage pass and everything. And we stayed a couple nights there, and it was good to just hang out again with, you know, people that were like you. So if anybody wants to look into it, it's Heart Support.